This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Doctors in Kenya's public health facilities have refused to work since December. They're demanding the government implement an agreement it signed in 2013 to raise salaries and improve working conditions. But the strike is taking a deadly toll on the nation's poor.
That's Raya Lombora reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, the humanitarian situation in Somalia is rapidly deteriorating as drought conditions worsen. And Pope Francis is considering a one-day trip to South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, doctors in Kenya's public health facilities have refused to work since December. They are demanding the government implement an agreement it signed in 2013 to raise salaries and improve working conditions. But the strike is taking a deadly toll on the nation's poor. Raya Lombor has the story from Nairobi.
Jared Ochieng lost his son Lamak to complications from leukemia.
The strike causes the death of my son. Because if not of that strike, then I could have got the assistance for how to cure my son in our national hospital, which is in the Kenyatta National Hospital.
Lamak was diagnosed with leukemia a year ago. When he started experiencing complications in early February, the family took him to the nearest hospital, Kenyatta National Hospital, one of approximately 2,500 public health institutions affected by the nationwide strike.
When I took my son to Kenyatta National Hospital, cancer department, there were no doctors. So the office that was just operating were the ones that made the arrangement for me to take the son to Texas. There were no doctors who are dealing in that part of leukemia because of the strike.
Texas Cancer Facility is a private facility in Nairobi, but the cost is too high for many Kenyans, making it an option of last resort. Some cancer patients have had no choice but to suspend treatment until public doctors return to work. The Kenya Cancer Association says it's getting reports of 3 deaths a week, a 50% increase compared to this time last year, says Program Director Moses Osani.
The doctor's strike has significantly affected the cancer patients in that most of them have had interrupted treatment. For example, if someone was to go for a cycle of 8 weeks and at the 6th week the doctors went on strike, then their treatment was interrupted, which meant they probably would have to seek treatment elsewhere.
The strike has also affected emergency medical services. Judy Nabwani says her son was hit by a speeding vehicle. She traced him 12 hours later to a country referral hospital where only basic first aid had been administered.
Venye nilifika hospitali, huyo kijana alikuwa amegongwa na gari.
She says he could not move or talk. He was just lying there. A nurse said the doctors were on strike and that the best thing to do was to refer him to a private hospital. He died before he could be moved. Nabwani said her son would not have died if he had been attended to on time. His cause of death was internal bleeding due to brain injury. The striking doctors have refused to resume work. Even after union leaders were arrested, the government has said it does not have the funds to implement the collective bargaining agreement it signed in 2013. Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union spokesperson Dr. Davis Ombui told VOA the union is pushing for much-needed improvements to the health system.
So far, we actually empathize with the situation. We know many Kenyans are losing their lives. Even us as doctors, we have relatives, we have friends, we have family. And it has affected us both. The narrative that you are sticking to is that we cannot go back to supervise deaths, as it were.
In addition to raising salaries, the 2013 deal called for the government to hire nearly 5,000 doctors over a 4-year period and equip hospitals with the necessary machines and drugs. Hopes are high that negotiations underway will end the strike, but for families of the deceased, it is too late. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Livestock insurance is paying off for about 12,000 pastoralist households in Kenya. The Kenyan government, in partnership with private insurance companies, have issued record payments in six counties facing a historic drought. The livestock insurance plan uses satellite imagery to monitor how much vegetation is available to livestock and trigger payments for feed and veterinary supplies. The imagery is also able to detect impending livestock losses, so water trucks can be sent to places where animals appear to be dying. Andrew Mude is the principal economist for the International Livestock Institute in Nairobi. He spoke with me about identifying drought risks and being able to respond to help herders.
We developed an insurance product, and the insurance product, what it would do is it utilizes information generated from satellites. So satellites have been collecting quite high resolution data, 250 meters by 250 meters every 10 days ever since 2000. And basically this satellite information gives you a sense of how much vegetation is on the ground. And in these systems, rangeland systems, livestock are principally consuming from the rangeland. So if you can get a sense of the average seasonal forage scarcity or forage availability, then you can get a sense of what the state of livestock will be with respect to the amount of forage being available. And this is what the satellites could track. Because you have data on it, you could write insurance contracts. And so basically, this is what the insurance covers. It covers forage scarcity of the season. And because in these systems, they link very well to livestock mortality or livestock stress, we are able to create what is called the index-based livestock insurance product, which triggered as a result of the current drought.
And because you all were using satellite imagery, you're able to avert future losses as well.
We've been working on this for a while, piloting it, revising and improving on the contracts. And the initial contract is what we call an asset replacement contract. And so this payout after mortality. And so the idea is it would help pastoralists restock. But over time, with improved technology and understanding the needs of the customer, they said, well, why don't you pay out in advance? You know, and we were able to do that in what is now being called an asset protection contract. So you can think about it as almost the difference between health insurance and life insurance. And so what this does, it aims to pay out before the loss so that the payouts can be used to purchase external feed, to purchase water.
Approximately 12,000 pastoral households were paid under this livestock insurance plan. So is this plan affordable for most people?
First of all, it's important to note that this is about 12,000 out of a total of 14,000 covered households. Given the scale of the drought, the insurance contract paid out to most people. Now, in terms of the cost, you know, the program that paid out and the press release is about, this is about the government program in which the government is contributing the full value of the subsidy. But there's another program that has been gaining momentum, and which is one in which the pastoralists pay quite a large component of the premium. Its coverage level is smaller, but what the government is working toward is growing its portfolio of subsidized but not fully paid coverage. The question being, you know, is this affordable? First of all, if you look at across the world, agriculture insurance products and programs are subsidized. But even in these systems, if you look at the alternative is pretty much what is happening now. You have the UN and other agencies who have declared famine in several countries in Africa. You have in Kenya itself, for those who have not covered, you have a huge public bill to respond to the devastation that is caused by the loss of these assets. And eventually what happens then is the loss of nutrients to the household level, of their ability to purchase food, of their ability to keep children in school. So the public impact is actually quite large. And a lot of the research we have shown is that the cost to the public coffer of purchasing insurance is actually offset by the benefit in terms of the foregone cost of having to respond in a costly manner to drought.
Can you tell us then, what is the overall benefit to having this type of insurance?
The main benefit to this type of product is disaster risk financial tool that allows for governments, for example, to respond to the impact of drought a lot faster. And we're seeing, you know, the impact and the cost of delayed response really weigh quite heavily on national governments and donors. And the fact that this product has paid out quite extensively in Kenya and the other areas we have, for example, in southern Ethiopia, and all pastoralists in those areas who are going through a type of severe drought and were covered by insurance have already received payments, and they can begin to then use those to protect their livestock and also to be able to purchase our food, which at this time has become very expensive. It has shown on balance to be quite a cost-effective way to be able to respond and to protect vulnerable populations from drought.
Andrew Moody is the principal economist for the International Livestock Institute. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
The UN warns that famine is a strong possibility in Somalia this year. It says the humanitarian situation is rapidly deteriorating as drought conditions worsen. Malnutrition and cases of drought-related disease are on the rise. Humanitarian agencies have shifted from a drought response plan, which has been in effect since 2015, to a famine prevention plan. The UN says nearly 3 million people are in crisis and in emergency conditions in Somalia, but more than 6 million overall are in urgent need of assistance. An $864 million appeal has been launched for Somalia this year.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the continued flow of refugees from South Sudan into Uganda has forced the UN Refugee Agency to open a new camp. The Mvepi camp is expected to hold up to 110,000 refugees. It's located in the Ara district in Uganda's northern province. A spokesperson for the UNHCR says recently there have been more than 1,300 new arrivals each day. He says well over 56,000 South Sudanese refugees have arrived in Uganda this month. Meanwhile, Pope Francis says he and his aides are considering a one-day trip to South Sudan and probably would be accompanied by the head of the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Several months ago, South Sudanese Catholic, Anglican, and Presbyterian bishops asked Pope Francis to visit the country.
Last week, South Africa's Gauteng High Court ruled that the government's attempt to withdraw from the International Criminal Court, ICC, was unconstitutional and invalid. That's because the government issued its withdrawal notice without consulting Parliament. The court ordered President Jacob Zuma and the Ministers of Justice and Foreign Affairs to revoke the notice of withdrawal. Otilia Ann Mungadisi follows the politics of the ICC at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. Reporter William Eagle asked her if she thinks the government will continue its efforts to withdraw from the International Criminal Court.
So far, the executive, through the Minister of Justice, Michael Masuta, has indicated that the South African government would still pursue possible withdrawal by going through Parliament as was directed by the court. What the government has not said as yet is what happens now with regards to the notice that is currently with the UN of withdrawal, which needs to be revoked. So indications are that the South African executive intends to push through with this. However, they will need Parliament first to vote on withdrawal, and should Parliament give them the go-ahead, then and only then would they be able to submit the notice of withdrawal again.
Tell us a little bit about the makeup of Parliament and the popularity or unpopularity among the parties in Parliament of the ICC. Is it likely that the Parliament would agree with President Zuma, for example, to try to revoke the membership to the ICC?
Just over 2 years ago, the African National Congress, which is the South African governing party at the moment, resolved at their annual general meeting to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. So that political party, at least in terms of that resolution, already made that decision. And it was as a result of that decision that eventually cabinet started to discuss the idea of withdrawal and eventually submitted that notice of withdrawal. However, the African National Congress would still need some support from other political parties in order for it to be able to succeed in voting for this withdrawal. At the moment, the two, sort of number two and number three in terms of the political parties, so the Democratic Alliance as well as the Economic Freedom Fighters, have indicated that they do not support withdrawal. the ruling of the Gauteng Division of the High Court was actually further to an application by the Democratic Alliance to nullify the decision by the executive. While the economic freedom fighters have indicated that while they do not necessarily fully support the International Criminal Court, what they would want to do is to be able for South Africa to contribute towards its reform and towards building it. So both those parties have not indicated that they wish to withdraw or they wish to support a motion to withdraw from the Rome Statute. At the same time, smaller political parties themselves have indicated that they would not support a motion for withdrawal. But it's always difficult to tell whether or not the African National Congress will entirely vote for withdrawal and whether or not they would be able to lobby a few extra votes to be able to allow for this motion to pass.
The African Union is said to be considering giving criminal jurisdiction over human rights issues to the African Court on Justice and Human Rights. Is this a potential alternative to the ICC? And is there also any movement in SADC or other regional groupings to investigate the abuse of power among leaders in their regions?
Well, the African Court on Justice and Human and People's Rights would only be able to exercise criminal jurisdiction once 15 countries have ratified the additional protocol that was adopted in 2014. To date, not a single African country has ratified that protocol, which means until such ratification has happened, the idea of criminal jurisdiction at the African court level is still very much an idea, and it's not something that has been put into practice. In terms of regional efforts to deal with international crimes, the Southern African Development Community Tribunal used to have jurisdiction over human rights cases, provided they related to violations of the SADC Treaty. That jurisdiction was removed by heads of state about 5 years ago. So at the moment, the SADC Tribunal does not hear human rights cases, let alone criminal prosecutions, and there are no indications that it would be enabled to do so. In the West African region, the ECOWAS Community Court does not deal with criminal prosecutions. However, it does deal with serious violations of human rights and has played an instrumental role in pushing countries within the region to actually do domestic prosecution. The most notable example is the successful prosecution of former Chadian President Hissène Habré in Senegal, which was really in large part due to a decision at the ECOWAS court level that essentially ordered Senegal to either prosecute Hissène Habré or to extradite him to a country that wanted to prosecute him. The East African Community Court is much similar to the SADC Tribunal in that while it still has some limited human rights jurisdiction, there are no indications there that it would do criminal prosecutions.
That was Otilia Anna Mungandisi of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
Since suffering a stroke in 2013, Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has rarely been seen in public. The stroke affected his mobility and speech. Last week, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's scheduled visit to Algeria was called off because Bouteflika had acute bronchitis. The ill health of the Algerian president has once more raised the question of who could succeed him in office. Mohamed Chakawi, professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University, spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the presidential power vacuum in Algeria.
There has been a clear vacancy of power for several years now. He is 79 years old and he has rarely appeared in public since 2013. He has been confined to a wheelchair after he suffered from a stroke. He has also taken long or extended medical leave. He spent time at the Val de Grâce Military Hospital in France. So for several years now, we have seen Bouteflika, who has not addressed his presidential role, but he has acted by delegating some of his strong men, like his prime minister, Abdelmalek Sellal, who has been the point man of several decisions, you know, under the promise that Bouteflika is ruling or is governing.
So if the Algerian president is not fit healthy-wise, how do you explain the lack of political will to replace him?
Well, that depends on what we make of legitimate political power in Algeria. We need to differentiate between two camps. One is the political and military and even intelligence elite or the old guard who have sought to perpetuate the symbolic value of Bouteflika. So we're looking at the symbol more than an operating president who was the pioneer of the National Accord when he came to power after the bloody civil war for more than 10 years. Second, we have the popular outcry to replace the ailing president with a rather fresh, young face who can implement the presidential tasks himself. So as I wrote in my book on the future of the Arab uprisings, there is a large-scale uproar among Algerians that has sparked a new social movement. It is known as Barakat or Enough or Ça Suffit in French. This is a new movement led by a protester. Her name is Amina Bourawi. She is a gynecologist and a mother of two, and she was the first activist to stand at the gates of her local university back in 2014 and to hold a placard that read, "Stop." So there is this popular demand. Still, you know, this popular contestation of Bouteflika's poor physical and mental health has been suppressed down by the alliance between a number of politicians, generals, intelligence officers, and even some financiers who have benefited from the status quo. And they are trying to perpetuate Bouteflika's presidential mandate until 2020 and beyond. So many Algerians now believe that Bouteflika has been hostage by his own direct entourage, and this is a recipe for a very complex conflict that will explode any moment.
So, in your opinion, what would change the status quo in Algeria, and what are the foreseen scenarios for succession in Algeria?
Bouteflika's deteriorating health remains a complex question about the possible political transition, since the majority of Algerians, especially the young generation, who want real democratization of politics as well as society. So there are several structural, socioeconomic, and cultural demands that have been put on hold. And I think the window now is closing on Bouteflika's team after nearly 3 years of his fourth mandate. So I would anticipate more traction in the street, more activism to embrace fair and transparent electoral process whenever it's going to take place. But we should not underestimate the strong will of the military institution and the whole entourage to resist this change. So I think the growing concern over Bouteflika's absence from the daily proceedings of his presidency implies a wait-and-see situation, because there are other politicians in the opposition who are basically waiting for the moment to contest the entourage of Bouteflika.
Mohamed Chakawi is a professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
Thanks for choosing the Voice of America. VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.